Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I promised that the third speaker is in the building, and I believe he is, but there's no sign of him just yet, so we'll get underway. My name is Jonathan Curtis, and I'm Assistant Secretary of the Research Branch here in the Parliamentary Library. Welcome to this morning's seminar titled Disconnect Between Opinion Polling of National Votes and the Results. We could perhaps have titled the seminar more provocatively, Does Opinion Polling Work Anymore? Internationally, elections in the US, the Brexit vote in the UK, the French election, and last week's UK election have delivered results that in various respects... Oh, we have a third speaker. Fantastic. That in various respects were at odds with pre-election predictions based on opinion polls. Does this mean polling is no longer a valuable guide to voting intentions? And what are the implications for Australia, particularly with our system of compulsory voting? Today's seminar will look at some of the issues that have arisen, and I'm pleased to welcome our three distinguished speakers. You've probably all read their potted CVs from the flyer, so I won't waste time running through them all again now, but in order, Professor Simon Jackman, who's returning for a second lecture, CEO of the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, Murray Goot, Emeritus Professor at the Department of Modern History, and Martin O'Shaughnessy, a partner at Omnipoll and a public affairs professional, leading public opinion pollster. As usual, each of the speakers will go for about 15 minutes, and then we'll have time for a question and answer discussion at the end. So please join me in welcoming our three speakers this morning.
Just bring this.
My presentation. Thank you. Great. Well, look, thank you so much for having me back again. And I remember the last time I was in this room, I was confidently predicting that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States. And so, in light of that, it's especially pleasing to be invited back. to explain perhaps why it didn't work out. So I'm going to briefly touch on three case studies, the American presidential election from November of last year, the Australian election from the middle of last year, and the recently concluded, last week, a British election, and draw some lessons from each of them. On the US presidential election, if you voted with your feet and come out this morning then to listen to this topic, then I can do really no better than commend to you the APOR report. That's the American Association of Public Opinion Research, AAPOR. They did a very deep dive indeed on polling around the American presidential election. A lot of people I have worked with and in some cases trained participated in the production of that report, and it's extremely detailed, and I can't commend it strongly enough. A lot of really wonderful analysis too, and if anything, a great case study on how to do some forensics on polling as well. You have the polling data pre-election, you've got the election results ex post, and what sort of analyses can or perhaps should one run to diagnose the performance of the polls. This report, I think, sets a new benchmark for that sort of exercise. The takeaways from that exercise are that the national polling in the United States was, it's not their language, this is mine, tolerable, is how I describe it. A lot of people go, I think there's this tendency in the industry in particular, say, well, the national polls were okay, we only missed in a few states. And that's true, but only up to a point. I think the national polls did tend to get it right, but the sample sizes that are being run, and in particular when one engages in aggregation exercises, that is averaging over multiple pollsters, at that point we're up to really large sample sizes in that combined sense, and then the collective bias that's left over is just simply too large to be explained by sampling error at that point. Once I poll, you know, poll A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, each of which might have 1,200, and each of which was conducted within 3 or 4 days of the election. I'm up now in many thousands, several thousands, approaching 10,000 responses. At that point, there isn't much sampling error to hide behind, and collectively, then I think we get to talk about the industry's performance as a collective, and it was better than what happened down at the state level. I think that's right, and perhaps I think this is true in line with the way national polls have tended to generally get the headline result right. But of course, it was one of those elections, like the 2000 election, where the election turned on this mismatch between the national popular vote and the Electoral College outcome. And as the 2000 election taught all of us, and indeed, I think in no small measure spurred this industry of poll aggregation and trying to make state-by-state forecasts, and that's an exercise I was engaged in the United States, and Nate Silver proved that there's indeed quite a healthy market, money to be made doing that. There's a real focus on the states, what's happening state-by-state, and that's a much harder exercise. And in that case, in 2016, the polls were really pretty awful in some places. What I've done here is to produce a scatter plot that has on the horizontal axis Clinton's margin as revealed in an average of polls that was compiled by Huffington Post using machinery that I essentially built for them in the 2012 cycle. I was the cheap version of Nate Silver for Huffington Post in 2012. They kept some of my algorithms and whatnot. I wasn't involved in this exercise, but it's essentially my intellectual property, if you will, that generates the numbers on the horizontal axis, averaging public polls out there and converting them into an average. It's not that difficult, but nonetheless, what's plotted on the vertical axis is actually the election outcome. And if the polls accurately predicted the election outcome, then all those data points would lie on the 45-degree line. The prediction would match the outcome, and all the data would lie on the 45-degree lines. The red dots are states won by Trump, and the blue dots are states won by Clinton. And this is hard to read from the back of the room, but this is the zero point. So this is where the polls are predicting Clinton wins, and these are states where the polls are predicting that Trump would win. And these off-diagonal quadrants here, this quadrant here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 data points here, are where the polls have predicted Clinton would win, but in reality, Trump won. And they are Florida, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and that was the ball game, as they say in the United States. The other thing I'd point out is look at the departure of these red points here from that 45-degree line. This is systematic error with respect to how Clinton actually did. And indeed, here we can see the difference, right? Lying below this 45-degree line means that we've come too far this way. The prediction is in excess of what actually happened. So these are, if you will, over-predictions of how Clinton did. And there's only a few over-predictions, and they're in these extremely blue states up here. But this sort of tale of woe here for the polls is really quite troubling. Some of these departures are really quite large. In some cases, double digits. The polls off by not just 1 or 2 points, but approaching 9 or 10 points in some cases. Really not a great performance at the state level. Number of reasons for this. The APOL report cites late deciders. I'm always suspicious when a pollster says that. Oh, we were fine, but what happened in that last 3 days? Everybody changed their mind. You go, well, that's convenient. Right. While we weren't looking, the world changed. And how would we know? Well, because the election result doesn't match the poll. So, okay. I think, and the APOL report, as good as it is, doesn't go into point number two here. And this is the thing about the United States, and it's the turnout game. Well, and perhaps the single biggest thing that distinguishes American polling from Australian polling. And it's that when you're polling in the United States, you're playing two games. One is to figure out who people are going to vote for, but more importantly, are they going to vote at all? And how you play that game is essentially so much of the accuracy of your poll. And if anything, I think the industry overlearned the lesson of 2012. 2012 had a black African-American man at the head of the Democratic ticket, as it did in 2008. And the coalition that assembled to make Barack Obama president of the United States essentially came out again in 2012. The electorate demographically looked very similar. The lesson people took away from that was that, if you voted in 2008, that's a great predictor of if you vote in 2012. Ergo, if you voted in 2012, that will be a great predictor of whether you voted in 2016. No. Right? What Trump and the Clinton contest did was to mobilize, and in some cases demobilize, elements of the electorate relative to 2012 and 2008. And not taking that into account was a big part of the story, particularly in those states where it mattered. Minorities and younger voters simply did not turn out to support Clinton the way they had for Obama. And Trump mobilized a number of people, particularly in rural sections of the upper Midwest, who are at best unreliable presidential voters. And I've given other talks, the lecture I gave in the lecture theatre down the front of the building a couple of months ago, I had a lot of data on that. There's little evidence of systematic kind of strategic behaviour by Trump voters. The so-called shy Tory phenomenon is how it first got to be called in the United Kingdom. But shy Trump voters, as I'm fond of saying, the word shy and Trump are an unlikely juxtaposition. And nor is there much evidence of so-called sly Trump voters, that is, let's messing with the pollsters as part of getting back at the system, systematically lying. There's little evidence of that either at this point. Okay. Australia 2016, I'll say a few things about that in contrast with the American case. And I should point out, everything I'm about to show you is joint work with Luke Mancilla, who's come up from Sydney to listen to proceedings today. Luke and I took some of the machinery I'd developed for earlier elections and applied it to the Australian 2016 case. Look, the industry did fine with the national two-party preferred numbers. It was 50-50, was a pretty safe call. And the other thing Luke and I find is a little evidence of big movement over the campaign, perhaps in contrast with what a lot of consultants and whatnot might tell you. It just doesn't appear to be Mediscare did this or that did that. And just not a lot of evidence of that. If you look over the long run, the things that move public opinion are changing who the Prime Minister is or announcing that you're going to have an election. People sort of wake up and go, oh, it's on. But this ad or that ad or Bob Hawke doing something on YouTube, not a lot of evidence of that really moved things around a little. An interesting feature of the Australian data, I'll show you in a second, is this persistent overestimate of the Green vote in Australian polling. Be interested in Martin and your take on that. Martin in particular probably seen that up close for a long time in his career at News Poll, might have some thoughts about that. And the other thing is that we're seeing more and more of this American game, and that is getting away from the headline national number. And a close election like the last one we had in Australia underscores perhaps the utility of doing this in the Australian context, and that is producing seat-by-seat numbers. ReachTel in particular was out there with a robo-polling operation, producing a lot of seat-by-seat numbers. They're so-so. We'll show you that in just a second. So there's the big picture over the... that's 3 years. That's October 13 to July 16. Was it the 43rd? Yeah, good. Okay. Made that slide. But you can see the big changes in public opinion here. So this goes Greens, two-party preferred number for the coalition, Liberal primaries and ALP primaries. You can see the big, almost a step function here is when Turnbull becomes Prime Minister, reclaims Liberal leadership, becomes Prime Minister. And this is, the Christmas New Year period at the end of 15 and 16, just horrendous. It's just like the country came back from holiday into early 16 and really didn't like that tax debate and bit of sort of policy drift, if anything. It's tough to rationalise it. But and the campaign itself is concentrated into this little window here, which we zoom in on now, and there's very little to suggest that once the election was announced, it's at least using the public polling, there's very little to suggest that there's a lot going on during the campaign. This bottom panel, again, in the back of the room, that'll be hard to see, but the way we fit this model is that we fit it ex post. We know the election results, so our model gets tethered to that point. Like, you know, if you were polling like an oracle on election day, you should have got the right result. And so that gives us a... We know that whatever line we draw through the rest of the data, it has to run through that point. And that's then how we're able to say, well, look at all this bias here. And there's lots and lots of polls that are overestimating green vote. You get some polls saying... I mean, in February of 16, someone's out there saying, this is probably Morgan, actually, green vote's on 16%. Like, really? You're not embarrassed by that? But anyway, no, I guess not. 16s, 15s, 14s, 13s, 12s, and the final result, of course, is down here, just around about 10%. But for the industry, just... Then that graph, by the way, is similar to the one you would make out of 2013 as well. It's interesting in the Australian context, and maybe these guys can talk about it later, so I won't say much. I'll just highlight it now. How you go from primaries to two-party preferred. Often, you can overestimate the Greens, but underestimate Labor, and it'll all wash out once you do two-party preferred, and you look good on two-party preferred, even though you may not have done a particularly great job with the primaries. Just another kind of little wrinkle in the Australian case to keep in mind. We're able to estimate bias by polling house, by party, and you can see here's this green phenomenon. Most these bias estimates by pollster, most of them lie above zero. Essential, if anything, underestimated Greens was a rare exception. News Poll Galaxy was bang on, and Ridgetail didn't do too badly as well. But Nielsen, a large overestimate of the green vote, and there's Morgan as well. Lonergan, we estimate some bias, but it comes equipped with this big confidence band because they didn't do many polls. And sort of that's the other. The more polls you do, the more I get to learn about your bias. If you don't do many polls, it's hard for me to say you were in the field when support was momentarily high for that party, unless it was right on election day. So that's why even estimating polling house bias is itself a little difficult. The more polls you do, the better I can calibrate house bias. If you look at the two-party preferred numbers, you see that collective most of these confidence intervals touch zero, that is, touch unbiasedness. There's almost no pollster. The example would be the only one really is Morgan, with an underestimate of coalition two-party preferred, and perhaps a News Poll Galaxy here. But just about everybody else, then there's another Galaxy poll, these multi-mode Galaxy polls. And Galaxy appears a number of times over this, the 2013 to 2016, because there was this various versions of Galaxy, Galaxy on their own, and then Galaxy when it was doing stuff that appeared in the News Limited Press under the News Poll brand. Maybe you can explain that transition to us better than anyone. I'll keep going. I'll get through this really quickly. Here's the seat-specific polling. It's not great. You can see the errors here are root mean square errors is a measure of the dispersion of the polls around the truth. And in turn, that allows us to compute the effective sample size of these seat-specific polls. And for Labor polls in particular, because they're pretty, there's a bit of bias here. The actual effective sample size of a seat-specific poll that you'll see in the newspaper is actually 92 people, right? And they'll say it's based on 400 people. Well, when you actually take into account how accurate those poles are, the right way to calibrate the confidence intervals is to inflate them by about 2.5 times. So when they say has a maximum margin error of 3 points, maximum margin error more like 8, and at which point you might say, well, what's the point? Which is a good question to ask. The other thing we did is compute, and another sign that something's amiss with these estimates are these so-called coverage rates, and that is, if I take a pole estimate and I form that margin of error, 95% of those 95% margin of errors ought to have the true result inside it. Right? And so what we can do is literally compute the number of times, the proportion of times, a 95% confidence interval includes the true result. For something that's behaving as it ought to, this number ought to be 95%. It's not, right? And this is another sign that there's bias and that the published confidence intervals are too small, and sort of gives you a sense of how large they have to be inflated. Last thing, I'll rip through this quite quickly. The last UK election was interesting. YouGov did very, very, very well. And they are crowing about it like mad on their website, and you could go and check it out for yourself. They got ridiculed ahead of the election for daring to suggest there might be a hung parliament. They got ridiculed for suggesting that Labour would do as well as it did. And how did they get it right? Well, what they did is they had a ton of modelling under the hood. And I think this is perhaps an interesting direction for the industry to go. Martin and I, before we were talking, before I started talking at least, said his new firm is not a fieldwork operation, it's a research shop. And I think the best polling places now are that. Just going to field and getting numbers versus making sure they make sense and may have predictive validity, that's a lot of work. But that's what good work in this field looks like, particularly when you're facing tricky situations like non-voluntary turnout, or you're trying to produce seat-by-seat numbers, say in the Australian case, even if you did have compulsory turnout. The tool that was used is something that I suspect we'll be hearing a lot more of in the near future. It's something that inside political methodology circles we've known about for a while. It's something called multi-level regression and post-stratification. The acronym for that is MRP. And statisticians would recognise it as a tool for repurposing national data to produce something called SAE, small area estimates. So I do a national poll because that's what I'm set up to do. But what I really want to do is produce regional or seat-specific numbers. How do I do that? Well, there'll be some modelling involved, and the tool du jour is this thing called MRP that YouGov used to great effect in the UK election. This has got some traction in Australia already, although you wouldn't have known about it. The work being done by Vox Labs, the people that run Vote Compass for the ABC, utilises this technique when they produce seat-by-seat numbers. And Luke and I and Sean Ratcliffe have a paper on this coming up pretty soon ourselves with how it performs in the Australian case. This is how YouGov did. There's that 45-degree line again, and the data are kind of clustered around the 45-degree line. If anything, they underestimated how well Labor did in Labor strongholds. They didn't do so well with the Scottish Nationalist Party. And here's just the seats they got wrong. In just looking at the English constituencies, putting Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland to one side, these are over-predictions of Labour and under-predictions up here. It was a good day out using the statistical tool. I'll stop.
Professor Murray,
to address you. Right?
Right, then.
I'm fine. Sorry,
yeah. All right. Good.
Okay. Your performance.
Well, this will be a Slido show. There's no competing with Simon. But I do have Roy Morgan at my side, who competes in a different sort of way. Addressing the Market Research Society in New South Wales a few weeks before the 1972 election, Roy Morgan confessed he had never read a textbook on statistics, nor on sampling, nor on public opinion polls, he said. If people wanted to know which party was going to win, he advised that they should ignore the poll figures because they're probably going to be all wrong and work out for themselves what they thought was right. After the election, the Herald and Weekly Times, which Morgan had run the Gallup poll since 1941, refused to renew his contract. There are two ways of assessing how good Morgan and others have been in predicting election outcomes. One is by looking at their success at picking election winners, and the other, in Simon's mode, is to look at their accuracy statistically. Looking at their success in picking the winner is not the preferred approach for the statistically minded, and for good reason. You can pick the winner, but be wildly inaccurate about how the vote actually divided. Equally, you can be pretty accurate, even if you have the wrong side winning. What gets polls discredited most easily is their failure to predict the winner. And while some pollsters claim to be in the reporting business, not in the prediction business, they are always keen to take credit for their poll if it turns out to be right.
Yep.
News poll comes to mind. Sometimes, of course, polls hedge their bets, as Simon has noted. X will win, provided it wins enough of Y's preferences, or Y will win if the last-minute trends are sustained, or people might change their minds. Sometimes pollsters say it's too close to call, a call that doesn't work if there's a landslide. Sometimes they just report the final figures without adding either their forecast or any qualification. None of these moves are guaranteed to save them. In 1961, in the days when Roy Morgan was the only poll in town, he had Menzies level pegging with Labour and therefore winning comfortably on DLP preferences, only to have the coalition finish 6 points behind Labour on first preferences, hanging on to government by the thread of one seat. In 1980, four polling outfits failed to pick the winner, with the only poll that foreshadowed the return of the coalition hedging its bets. And in 2001, after Gary Morgan had Labour winning by its biggest margin since the war, Packer's Bulletin showed him the door, post-fact. Morgan had survived a poor call in 1996 when he badly underestimated the coalition's performance. He wasn't going to survive an even worse call in 2001. Now, how well do the polls do in terms of statistical accuracy? Here there are a number of measures. One is the difference between the first preference votes for the government and opposition and the estimate of this difference in the final polls. Between 1943 and 1969, when the Morgan Gallup poll had the field to itself, though its polls were all conducted about a week before the election, it's quite a long time out by the current standards, Morgan regularly overestimated support for the Coalition or for Labour. On four occasions, its error was 2 percentage points or less. On three occasions, 3 percentage points. And on no less than three occasions, it was 5 or 6 percentage points. 1961, but also 1963 and 1966, estimating the gap between Labour and the Coalition in first preference terms. In addition, Morgan struggled in his attempt to measure support for the DLP, underestimating it every election from 1955 to 1963. Problems with minor parties like Greens are not new. Morgan's average error in estimating the government's or opposition's first preference lead was 3.9 percentage points over this period, a figure that includes an underestimate of 13 percentage points in his estimate of Labour's lead in 1943. In 7 out of 11 elections, Morgan exaggerated the coalition's position relative to Labour. In only 2 did it underestimate it. One consequence was Rupert Murdoch's decision in the run-up to the 1972 election to establish a new poll, ANOP, as an outfit that might be kinder to Labour. You'll remember Murdoch backed Labour in 1972. Since 1972, Australia has seen at least 3 pollsters at every election. In recent years, as many as 8. We can divide the years from 1972 into 2.
1972 to 1994, before Murdoch helped create another poll, News Poll, and the years from 1987, when News Poll walked among us. Between 1972 and 1984, the polls were roughly as accurate or inaccurate as they had been in the Morgan years. Of the 29 polls that attempted to predict the outcome in these more competitive years, no fewer than a third erred by at least 5 percentage points in estimating the gap between the government and the opposition. In another third, the error was a more acceptable 3 to 4 percentage points. Since 1987, the News Poll era, the number out by 5 percentage points or more has dropped to about 1 in 5. The proportion out by 3 or 4 points has dropped to about 1 in 4. That means just half the final polls have got to within 2 percentage points of the government's actual first preference lead. How well has News Poll done? Not much better than average. Half its estimates have erred by 3 percentage points or more, half by 2 percentage points or less. A second measure is the average polling error for all the parties, that is, on which all the polls choose to report, including that grab bag called others. In the four elections conducted between 1946 and 1954, Morgan's average error for the Coalition, Labour and others was 0.9 percentage points. In the six elections conducted between 59 and 69, when the DLP was up and running, Morgan's average error was nearly twice as great, 1.6 percentage points. When polling became competitive from 1972 up to 1984, the election before the establishment of the News Poll, about half the polls erred by between 1.8 percentage points on their average error per party. The other half divided pretty evenly between those who were out by less than 1 percentage point per party and those that missed by more than 2 percentage points per party, which is a sizable miss. And the News Poll years from 1987, somewhat better. Nonetheless, only 1 in 5 of the averages was out by less than 1 percentage point, while 1 in 5 was out by more than 2 percentage points. More often than not, the average error per party has been in the range of 1 to 1.8 percentage points. News Poll's average was 1.2 percentage points. This was better than several other polls, AGB, Nair, Morgan, Nielsen, Sorwick, of ancient memory. But it wasn't as good as three of the more recent arrivals on the scene. Galaxy, like News Poll, a telephone poll until 2016. Essential Research, conducted online. And Regtel, a robo-poll. All three had average errors per party not of 1.2 percentage points, which was News Poll's record, but of 0.9 percentage points. Note, too, that all three were better than News Poll using completely different modes, including one mode, robo-polling, that most pollsters elsewhere in the world would run a mile from. My last measure is the average error in the polls estimate of the two-party preferred, a measure that is unique to Australia. Until 1993, few pollsters produced a two-party preferred. Now it's the predominant measure, largely because it's the best predictor of the number of seats that the government and opposition will gain or lose, given a certain swing. That's why there'll be no rush for the YouGov model. In the 9 elections held since 1993, nearly a third of the final 50 polls have overestimated or underestimated the two-party preferred by 2 percentage points or more. Another third have erred by between 1 and 1.8 percentage points. Only 40% of the polls have got within 1 percentage point of the actual figure. And News Poll, with an average error of 1.1 percentage points, it's far from the worst, but nor is it the best. Again, Essential Research, Galaxy and Regtel have been as good or better. Writing after the 1972 election, David Butler, the Oxford sophologist, visiting Australia, suggested that if, quote, an enterprising rogue had set up a pseudo-poll that conducted no interviews, but simply worked on the assumption that every election Labor and the Coalition would each get 46% of the first preference vote, they would not have had too bad a record. An average error between 1958 and 1972, he calculated, of under 2.5 percentage points. If the same rogue had allowed for the general consensus that 1966 would be a good year for the Liberals and 1972 would be a good year for Labor, their record would have matched Morgan's. In similar vein, we could say that if in 1993 an enterprising rogue had worked on the assumption that at every election Labor would get 50% of the two-party preferred, then in 2010 that rogue would have had an even better record than Butler's rogue, an average error of just 1.8 percentage points. As it happens, 1.8 percentage points is the median error for the three polls, News Poll, Morgan and Nielsen, with the records that stretch from 1993 to 2010, the last election in which all participated and in which all three polls used telephone interviews. If my rogue had worked out which party was likely to get the majority of the two-party preferred, generally not a difficult task, their record would have been better than the polls. The record of the polls in estimating vote shares in single or marginal seats, as Simon has stressed, is a good deal worse than their records in relation to the national vote. It is likely, therefore, the task of a pretend pollster in beating the professionals would have been even easier. But all this is over the long run. A median error stands midway between worse outcomes, some much worse, and better ones. Given that a contract the newspaper might be at stake with any one call, or your reputation as a market researcher on the line, polling has never been for the faint-hearted. True, the task in Australia has always been made easy by compulsory voting, but from the earliest days there have been worries about the representativeness of samples and the problem of weighting. There's always been concern about how to manage the don't knows. Assume that they'll divide like the rest of the respondents, look at their past vote, their views of the leaders, or use your experience as a pollster. And there's always been concern about whether those respondents who might probably be called undecided might change their mind between the last poll and election day. From the mid-1950s, there's been concern about under-reporting or over-reporting for the minor parties. From the early 1990s, there's been concern about how to distribute minor party supporters in order to derive a two-party preferred, not least when the parties are new and there's no history to go by. And increasingly, pollsters face the need to think of different modes of sampling, in some cases mixed modes, if they are to reach younger respondents in particular. A collapse in response rates from somewhere north of 70% in the 1940s to somewhere south of 10% today. Not to mention the problem of voters who are attracted to parties that may not be running in many seats. When the pollsters get it wrong, there's likely to be a period of soul-searching, assuming pollsters have souls. Sometimes, though not yet in Australia, there may be some sort of inquiry. But perhaps we should attend to the polls with equal amusement when the pollsters get it right, and with equal curiosity when the figures don't move from week to week or fortnight to fortnight in the polls. After all, the chances of this occurring, even where public opinion itself hasn't shifted, is not great. For Roy Morgan, what mattered was getting his prediction as close to the final figures as he could. How he got there was entirely secondary. The pressure on pollsters since Morgan's days hasn't diminished. If anything, under competition, the pressure has increased. Herding, to use Nate Silver's rather anodyne term, has been one response. Pollsters looking over their shoulders to see what other pollsters have come up with and bringing their own figures into line. If the herd is wrong, you go down with the herd, but at least you've got company. In Australia, herding can be seen as early as 1972, the first election with competitive polling. After the August 1972 budget, Morgan thought the coalition, quote, home and hosed. But 3 weeks out in the election, he fell into line with ANOP and Sorlick to predict a Labour win. Before 1972, Herding wasn't possible because Morgan had no competition. And in marginal seat, it's still not possible because there's no herd to follow. Any seat is unlikely to attract more than one or two pollsters spread over very different points in the campaign. And samples in marginals are so small that looking over one's shoulder wouldn't make much sense anyway. One of the reasons, therefore, that polling in marginal seats is woeful is that there's no one to cheat against. If the average error per party is around 1 percentage point on the first preference vote, and the average error on the two-party preferred is at least as high, the poll should be treated with considerable caution, especially in the inter-election period. Greater caution than common among editors keen to boost their exclusives or among journalists telling us what each little shift from one fortnight to another really means. Graphs in the papers in shaded areas, with shaded areas for the margin of error, as in Simon's presentation, might help. But don't expect anything to change. Having paid for the polls, the media have to beat up their stories. That aside, the polling industry needs to be much more transparent. Readers of the polls should have access to the exact questions and response options, the questions used to reduce the number of don't knows in the responses, methods of weighting, how the data differ from different sampling frames are spliced together when the modes are mixed, the methods used in dealing with the don't knows, and the means by which the two-party preferred is calculated. In his remarks that I quoted at the beginning to the Market Research Society late in 1972, Roy Morgan boasted that his success in predicting the outcome of the 1970 election, he said, when the computer sheets were there and Gary and others told me what to write, as in Gary Morgan, I said, that's a lot of rubbish. I sat down and wrote what I thought it was, and they said I was wrong, but I was right. In Australia, we need a body similar to the British Polling Council, but one that demystifies successes, not just one that seeks to unravel failures. Thank you.
Well, I won't take further. First, an organisational question given the time. Who will leave right on 10:30? 11:30, good. Otherwise, you've already left. Okay. In which case, I will now begin my presentation. As Murray will know, at News Poll, every poll contained a full statement of methodology that covered everything except the way we allocated preferences, although it was always stated in the text that we allocated them based on previous election. And quickly on the issue of the Greens, lots of people want to vote Green, but the Greens never had the resources to provide how-to-vote cards at every polling booth, and as a result, they turn up and vote for somebody else. But if where the how-to-vote cards are handed out by the Greens, such as in the Melbourne seats we've seen in recent elections, they've got exactly the kind of vote they thought they would get, and plenty of people predicted the victory in Melbourne of that first Greens candidate, Adam Band. So it's purely a technical thing. As soon as the Greens have enough people, hands on the ground, to actually do the work, their vote will actually reflect what's in the polls, as generally speaking, in spite of the other comments that have been made, we see that most of the major polls actually point you in the right direction, generally speaking. Okay, what I'm going to do is look at inside the observations that have been made here and answer this quick question. Can we actually have faith in the polls in Australia? And I say, at least to a certain extent, yes. But there are a couple of things that we need to watch out for, and they've been touched on. The challenges that sincere pollsters, who state their methods and try to do it right, and I might say to you, unlike Gary or Roy, I have always published exactly the number that came out of my system, even though I got that hot phone call from Chris Mitchell going, that can't be right, Labor can't possibly win in 2007, blah, blah, blah. To our own pain we did, usually we got it right. Okay, so polling 101. Hands up those who understand polling or stats in any way. A lot? A little? Not at all. Okay, we'll do that one. Oops, sorry.
And then we'll go through what were the main causes of the recent polling issues in the states, and I'll go a little deeper into the APOR stuff. And then we'll look at our reasons for confidence in the Australian polls, which are systematic rather than having faith in the individuals. And then I want to point out a big challenge that people in our industry face that actually people in this room or people in that one downstairs can actually do something about. Okay, polling 101. Every voter needs a chance to participate in the survey. So you need to choose a method that gets to those people. You need to give them a chance to do it, and you need to weight the results to reflect who they are, because you always miss somebody. Rule number two, the sample has to reflect the population. So we set quotas because we can't get to everybody randomly, and we sample by electorate, and we build samples that, you know, try to piece together Australia the way it actually is. And in fact, to the point of using Australian Electoral Commission role statistics to create our quotas and to our weighting statistics. And then if you want to project a state or a marginal electorate, you actually have to measure that and build your sample around it. This other modelling is okay, it works fine, but actually in terms of this kind of stuff, using the tools that are available or were available to me at NewsPoll, we would build things that exactly reflect the environment we're attempting to describe. So they're the three rules that everyone has to do right just to get the numbers in the right ballpark, 2%, or the margin of error normally around 3%. So let's look at the causes of recent controversy. There are a number of things that were specific. That's interesting. Just bear with me for a second. Oh, yeah, OK. There are some things that were specific to the US. Complexity. Their electoral college system is very difficult to measure. And it's expensive to measure because there's 50 of them and you've got to do 50 really good polls to know the exact result. Which makes it very hard to follow rule number three, which is construct your polls to reflect the structure. The turnout issue. You don't know who's going to turn out. So it makes it very, very difficult to follow rule number one. Who are you measuring? And giving everyone who will vote the opportunity to be in the survey. And these one-off things, the disaffected, the unpollable, the people in the, the white singlets in the northwestern states who have never voted before and possibly will never vote again. So they are systematic things. But I think the most important thing about the United States election was that most pollsters inflicted the wounds on themselves by doing bad work. And I think Simon's touched on that at the state level. One of the main findings of the APOR study was that many pollsters at the state level failed to wait for education, which is in America, and quite bad in Australia, but we never do it. Never fail to do so. And then this herding, or the self-reinforcing predictions, in particular Nate Silver's outfit and people like him, who loudly proclaimed a very clear victory for Clinton. Then there are the issues affecting everybody. Some of these are fixable. The cost-quality squeeze that pollsters and their clients are facing. Why do people do crappy polls? Because it's too expensive to do good ones and newspaper editors have budgets. And that's true in Australia and the states. And access to good sample. The telephone poll used to be the gold standard. And the reason it was so much better than Roy's work was because Roy used door-to-door sampling, which was cluster sampled, and statistically, mathematically, it's not as good. And that's the whole reason for it. But telephone sampling used to be able to get to everybody. Now it can't. And I'm going to show you a bit about that, which of course makes it very hard to follow rule number one, to give everybody a chance of being sampled. I'm speaking quickly because I'm thinking 15 minutes. Okay. So here we go. Let's look at complexity. I'll do this quickly. This is a picture of America. And this is a picture of Australia. Okay. When we look at this picture of America, we can see that these colleges are like our states. There's 50 of them. But they all have different numbers of votes. They have different populations. They have optional, unpredictable turnout. And in fact, the national estimates were generally correct, but they're useless. They have no bearing at all on the result because it's electoral college votes that determine the outcome. So if you get two close calls wrong, and I'll make an example, Florida, 26 seats, Wisconsin, 10. You can either get that wrong by 16 by getting one wrong, one right. You can get it wrong by 36 by getting them both wrong. Okay, 36 electoral college votes out of the 270, 37 you need to actually get the election. If we look at Australia, though, every electorate has the same population, just about. That's why we have an electoral commission. And every seat has one value, one seat. And compulsory, predictable turnout. And in fact, we campaign for it, for turnout. And the National Two Party gets it within a couple of seats nearly every time. So in Australia, if you get two marginals wrong, they might cancel each other out, giving you no effect on the winner call that you make. Or, you know, one wrong, two wrong, three wrong. You know, the number that you get wrong out of the 150 seats is like 1 or 2%. So in Australia, the system is actually inherently easier to measure and therefore measured better. And I'll give you a quick example. So this is Australia in 2013. I'm using News Poll. The poll swing and the theoretical results. So the swing was -4.5 just coming into the election, which suggested 14 seats would change hands. If you just took the real result at the election, it was 3.5%, pretty close to that number. If it was 0.5%, that was mine. 13 seats would have changed hands, and because of the vagaries of marginal seats, 17 actually did. So 13, 14 and 17 are very close together. So anybody in Australia with a good two-party could have probably got the, you know, who was going to form government right. In the recent American example, right, the best polls showed the anti-Clinton swing, or the anti-blue swing, at 2.6%, which, you know, reading straight off their numeric system, would have given you a 30-seat difference. Yeah, okay, they could stand that. The actual swing was 2.9%, very close to the average of the polls, which would have been 16 seats. As a matter of fact, with that swing, 105 seats or electoral college votes were lost because of the uneven distribution of the state swings, and therefore their system, inherently hard to measure and often measured badly. Okay. So, if you want to precisely do a US election, you need 150 separate polls. They have to be done at the state level. They have to be high quality. They have to ignore national estimates, and they need to get the states right. What actually happened was 39 national polls, all got pretty close, 208 state polls, average error 5.1%. Most got it very wrong. So that's what happened in the states, and that doesn't happen here. Okay, anticipating turnout. This is really hard, but the basic idea here is in 2016, people drew a different idea of what would happen. In particular, a number of polls adjusted turnout to align with what happened in 2013, and they got it wrong. Simon's already pointed that out. So, these one-off features in the states, the one-off big one, is the lopsided turnout. That really happened, and that's why some of the polls people would have expected to go to the blues went to the reds. I keep returning because I've been told the microphone won't pick me up over there. There was a strong divide on education in the vote and the turnout. And that meant, you know, those who used their 2012 models, again, got it wrong because they assumed in 2012 they found there wasn't a strong divide on turnout and vote based on education. And we can show that graphically later. And something yet to be studied is those disaffected voters. Who were the people who turned out for the first time and maybe never again? And, you know, were unpollable as a result? And simply missed over because, you know, methods are expensive. If the people are hard or unwilling to poll, yeah, in that system, you might skip over them, and I think they frequently did. As I say, though, the main problem with the American situation in 2016 was what I decided to call their self-inflicted wounds. First, cost pressure led to a large number of poor quality polls at the state level, and this is from the APOR report. See, there were about a third of all the polls were high quality, operator-made telephone polls. Another big grunt here were the IVRs, and, you know, there were some quite good large online polls conducted in the middle. Here we have the state polls. Mainly the biggest single group of those polls was done online, and of course they exclude vast numbers of the population and very small numbers of a whole hodgepodge of other combined methods. And as a result, what you got was a very inconsistent view of the electorate through all these different methods.
And as a result, you know, as Simon pointed out, a big scatter plot in the state level polls. This one in particular, they didn't actually wait for education. Not that they got it wrong or they tried or whatever, they just didn't do it. And this is why so many state polls were wrong and why the average error was 5%, and as Simon said, up to 10. But here are the stats. Right? This is from the American Voter Survey. We see that the turnout at each election by education level, so the blue is the postgraduates, they are the most, or the dark purple, are the most likely to turn out. They're also the most likely to be polled, and if you didn't know that and you didn't include that in your estimates, then you were going to get it wrong. And here, you know, is this lovely split which says, if you are an educated voter, you will vote blue. So, we've got a system where they're polling blue voters and keeping them in the model. They are not waiting for the fact that they're more educated. They go out there and they find that the educated people want to vote blue, but they don't mix that difference. They don't cut away or wait for this difference here. The result is you're going to get it wrong. No matter what you do, you'll be wrong, unless by luck. Nate Silver. He's just one, but he's the one with the face. All the rest are just websites. He's not a pollster, right? Let's forget this guy. He's one of the problems. I mean this with sincerity, no? They rely on the polls. They use our work and then tell us that they're better than us. That's a self thing. But what happens is if you've got a bunch of poor quality state polls, they bring them in. They rely on them. They have to. So it's a case of garbage in, garbage out. Just that simple. The weights that they use, very sophisticated. A lot of it's eyeball, though, when you read Nate's justification after 2012. So, yes, they are weights, and the system he uses is pretty good, but it's still his system and subject to confirmation bias. Okay, so he eyeballs it, puts the stuff in, and comes out with a 70% likelihood of a Trump victory. Of a Clinton victory. What did I say? So, those guys react to the volume of inputs that they get. There were 208 bad state polls. So they were published, then they went into the system and they produced these strong, you know, Clinton's going to win, which led to more models predicting Clinton winning, which led to confidence in the bad polls and looking to the federal polls, and a self-feeding cycle of overconfidence in a bunch of bad predictions. Also, I think people who looked in possibly found the state polls a bit ambiguous because there were wide margins between pollster X and Y on state estimates. And so backing away from that, I think a lot of commentators then started to merely look at the federal numbers because they couldn't understand what was happening at the state level. Federal numbers are not predictive, we've just shown that. Now, I just want to stop for a second while I'm on self-inflicted wounds. Speaking as someone who's advised a politician, this is what happened in the British election. This is what actually happened at the 15 result. 36.8% went to the Conservatives, 30% to Labour. At the time that the election was called, Ipsos Mori had them 23 to Labour and 44 to the Conservatives. Great time to go to the polls. And in fact, except for underestimating, as everybody else did, the Labour result, the number for the Conservatives across the top was pretty good. 44 to 42.4, I'd have been happy with that. So what went wrong? The polls kind of got it right. Everybody missed what Labour was doing. But more importantly, Theresa May, who goes to an election on a honeymoon poll? That's, everybody knows that right after the poll, the vote of the winner goes up. And Ian McAllister's study shows even that people will say they voted for the winner to a greater extent. They get 3 or 4% boost in what people claim they did after the election. So we all know that you don't trust the honeymoon. But that's exactly what the British Conservative Party did. They went to the polls on a honeymoon and they paid the price. It was just dumb. A very strongly a self-inflicted wound. Okay, why are we confident about Australia to some degree? Except for the mea culpas that I owe you. Pardon its text. But our voting system is far more monolithic. Okay? We have a less granulated system. Our polling units are all the same size, electorates. Our turnout is compulsory, meaning that a poll of everybody is going to be a poll of electors. So the basics of our system are easier to measure, getting to everybody is easier, and as a result, you know, our polls generally do quite well. So, when we think of our polling system, I've already pointed out that our lack of complexity means that the relevance of national estimates is good. It's tended, as Murray said, to predict the outcome quite well. And in fact, instead of doing 150 very accurate state-level polls to get a good result, where I've done well, and by the way, I've always submitted a final opinion on the number of seats to change hands to the newspaper based on marginal seat polling. The secret with marginal seat polling is not to poll individual seats, but to pick the 10 most marginal in each state, build a quality sample around that group, work out some averages, and a little bit of modelling that shows where there are, if you like, lumps in the beach. The tide is going up. There's one at 3%, there's one at 6%. If you've got a big swing, it's going to go past 6, but if it's something less, you'll probably only lose those seats that are held by 3% or less. In 2007, I predicted that we would lose that the Howard government would lose 25 seats. They lost 24. So that was our... It's in the paper. Thank God I got that in. The other thing is our landscape, as pointed out by Simon, mainly favours quality. There are... Even though we have half a dozen pollsters, we're all measuring the same thing. And, you know, generally speaking, we're competitive with one another. And as a result, you know, we're all working towards getting that number right and looking good at the end. I can say with complete certainty that until 2015, News Poll always weighted by education. And we had very tight structures of age and sex within each area. We measured Australia at a total of 61 sub-areas. Our phone room usually, on the ones that I wanted to count, usually took 2 days more to do that than the standard type stuff that you could wait for. I don't know, I can't tell you the methodology that my successor is using because he doesn't publish it and you can't find it in the paper. Also, our Electoral Commission and our ABS are treasures beyond measure, and any influence you can bring that will make sure those guys continue to be properly funded, because they provide that basic information about the structure of the electorate and the structure of society that we need to create good samples and weight. Okay, so, finally, how did we actually do? You know, what does all of that boil down to for people who are watching the polls? And these are the News Poll two parties from 93 to 16. I'll point out that I took over in 2007. Compared to the US national and US state results. And you can see, on the whole, not only do we have a simpler system, but we also have polls that are generally closer to the results that are being predicted. Or we never predict, but, you know, we get accused of that. So, on the whole, we've done better in recent years. But surprises can happen. These three familiar faces, well, he might not be familiar to you, my brand from South Australia, all won on results less than 50% of the two-party vote. So thank you, Murray, for checking those numbers for me. So it can happen, and, you know, I wonder what Australia would have been like if those fellas hadn't won. Okay, the big challenge for pollsters everywhere, and, you know, my sales pitch to you, or my plea to you, people with influence. Things you really got to have to do good polling is to know the population you're measuring, to know your electorates, and to get to everybody. Now, the AEC and the ABS allow us to understand the structure, and so we can design things that can get to and represent everybody. But the old gold standard of telephone is really suffering at the moment. And Murray talked about, you know, how accurate some methods are. The basic rule of getting to everybody, that's the one we're talking about now. And it was a big problem in the American election, as we know. This chart shows who is excluded, the red part is the exclusion, by each method currently being used for polling. Landline telephone excludes over 30% of people, in particular people between 18 and 35. Online panels, 98%. Only 2% of people are on the largest panel. There are people on multiple panels. If you use one panel of 160 or 200,000 people, 98% of the population aren't capable of being selected, and this is why we use this for commercial stuff, not for published polling. Mobile phones, there are 35 million mobile services in Australia,
And in fact, people who don't use mobile, 7% to 93% and growing, are reachable by mobile phone. Now you say, good old Martin, use the mobile phone to call people, right? It's exactly what I want to do, but there is a problem. And that is that there is no mobile phone book. In the old days, there was a thing called the phone book. And we used to use it. We'd take a page out of it or get an electronic copy of it. There is a thing which has every phone number in it. It's called the IPND. And it's owned by, well, it's run by Telstra for the Department of Communications and managed by ACMA. And over the last 7 years, my industry has been working with these organisations to gain access, de-identified information, to these phone numbers so we can call everybody and get back to what we were doing before. The shortage of phone numbers in the real world is such that the extra work we do to quota up and get to those other people who aren't reached and to build our quotas of young people who are, you know, less and less found on the phone, in 2014 added 20% to my costs. So as a business, that's making it very hard to do good polling and very hard, in fact, to do market research. So we've got to the point where we have access to everything except the mobile phone numbers. The current setup is, the industry body is ANZRO, and we've just been granted access to everything that was in the old phone book. So we have a model to do it with, but there's this group of, you know, protected species called the mobile phone number that is, at the moment we're working with ACMA, in particular the Department of Communications, to just go the next step and, you know, I think remove the sense of sensitivity around what a mobile number is. I think once upon a time it used to be a private thing, something different to the listed number. As an artefact of how the world evolves, the mobile phone number was never listed in the phone book automatically. And as a result, it tends to be regarded as an unlisted number, though no one's ever said, I don't want to be listed. So we're working through that process. If you hear any chatter about that or have any understanding of that, think about it. The polling that we're doing and the other things are very important. And I've said, you have a stake in this because about $1 in every $5 spent on research is spent by a government department, planning services, measuring how well they're delivered, controlling the level of communication going out, you know, not wasting budgets. So I mean, people in this room do have a stake in us succeeding here. Okay, that's how we fix it. That's the fin. Now, there were questions. There were questions you wanted me to answer, weren't there? The questions...
ladies and gentlemen, I'm aware we're running a little over time, and so my apologies for that. I appreciate some of you will need to run off, but I think we still have a few, with the leave of our speakers, a little time for a few questions. So, any questions from the floor? Carol?
We talk about compulsory voting in Australia, but we don't have compulsory enrolment. And there are a big group of young people who are not enrolled to vote. When you're doing the polling, how do you take into consideration those? Because I'm just wondering if that's part of the reason the Green voted or if it's not. Because those people might say they vote Green, but they're not on the
Yes, we've done a number of studies for the Electoral Commission on this and found enrolment levels above 85 in the Northern Territory up to high 90s of those eligible, that is, citizens of the age, in the minor states, the smaller states. The good thing about our system is, let's just talk about polling, when you do a poll, you say, are you eligible to vote, not are you enrolled? Because, as we know, people turn up and do a declaration vote and it's about 5% of all votes cast. So we're measuring who's eligible, and because of the way, you know, our wonderful AEC campaigns to get people A, enrolled, B, to turn up even if they're not, usually the eligible group is very well reflected in our polling. So, and it's also very well reflected in turnout on the day. So, you know, an extra 5% turn up, I think, with declaration votes, so they're, you know, not registered, but they're there because the election is on and they want to have their say. So that lines up very closely with what we find when we ask for eligible voters in our poll. And we've done the are you eligible, are you registered? And, you know, there's about a 7-8% difference in what people tell you.
One little wrinkle there is automatic enrolment updates that I think the last Australian federal election kind of inflated the denominator of enrolled voters, and so turnout statistics for Australia at the last election were no longer the 93, 94, 95, 96 that, you know, were 90, I think, is the...
91,
Yeah, 1991. That still makes Australia a very easy cake to slice, relatively speaking. But I think it speaks to the room for slippage between Gen Pop and who's going to turn up on election day. And I wonder if it's... Is it part of the Green story? That it's... You know, I know you say the How to Vote card, and I hadn't thought of that one before, but what if you'd asked me before this morning, my operative hypothesis was young people who don't ever act together and if they are contacted by a pollster, will say, I'm going to vote Green, but on that particular Saturday morning, didn't get around to it. And that's part of the story. You know, the reason I bring that up is to say I wonder if that's part of the turnout story too. Automatic enrollment swept up a number of people that ordinarily, you know, might fit that profile.
That's definitely the case. And when you think, let's say a Green vote of 8%, the 1% error on that is 12% of the whole thing, and it looks like a big number. The other thing, though, is when I was thinking about this, I studied One Nation and their rise, and we found the same thing, that the more popular they got, the more seats they ran in, the higher the actual turnout, the higher the actual votes in the box for them. And it kind of went with if they had people at the polling stations and running candidates. So the more places they ran, the higher their vote. That kind of makes sense, but also the higher their Senate vote. And as a result, there's a parallel of a rise and a tendency for the polls to initially underestimate because no one knows where they are and they turn up in the Senate, and then a tendency once the poll party gets rolling to overestimate because people have heard about it, they want it, but they can't get it. It's like going to the supermarket and not getting the brand you want. And in fact, a lot of people will say they'll vote Green in an electorate where no Green is running, and that is because it's lower house. You know, that's critically important. So we'll be picking up people in Western Australia saying they want Green when there was no Green candidate. And later, as you know, in the later polls, we try to fix that by only asking the question of... We knew what seat they were in. And that took some doing. Mm. Yes?
I could be wrong on this, but I think since 2001, Greens have run all lower house contests. So one of the possible... another confounding factor in bias for estimates is split ticket voting. Different pollsters have different question wording, so how we vote in elections, and some specify how you vote for the House of Representatives, how you vote for the Senate. And it is quite common knowledge in political science that the average voter does not have a very high level of political knowledge. How many people know that there is a Senate and that there is a House of Reps? Very few can distinguish between the two.
But Luke, the pollsters hardly ever ask about the Senate, because the Senate is rather like the American system where you need to conduct a large sample in each state rather than a national sample which you then split.
Precisely. So there's perhaps there is the possibility for split-ticket voting, whereas people vote in the Senate for the Greens, whereas in the House of Reps...
If you open-ended, people will tell you they want to vote Xenophon in a federal election. Mm. We've tried that. Yeah. But so now we base it on lists of candidates running and complicated that by knowing what seat they are in and at the end having a list of candidates as well.
Gentlemen, I think we should probably wrap it up because we are 20 minutes overdue. Please join me in thanking our three speakers. For those who can spare a couple more minutes, there is some tea and coffee at the back, and I'm sure our speakers will be happy to continue the conversation. Thank you very much.
I like the number of